This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Buy the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Buy the Book. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Alongside me today, my fellow optimist, Sharmila Ganesan. And today, we are going to actually be speaking with somebody who has been somewhat in the news lately, partly for a TED Talk, partly because there is a new book out, published May 2020. And that is, of course, Rutger Bregman, who is a Dutch popular historian and author of Humankind, A Hopeful History, which is what we're going to be diving into today. Rutger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for the book. I tremendously enjoyed reading it, actually.
Oh, I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah, we both did. We had several conversations about it.
So maybe the best place to start would be the beginning, because you talk about these several pivotal moments in the book where you had a sort of a shift in thinking about pre-existing concepts or findings. But was there one specific experience or train of thought that led you to start researching on that idea behind Humankind?
Huh. You know, the book is really about a silent revolution that has taken place in science. So the reason I wrote it is that I started to notice that so many different scientists from so many diverse disciplines, you know, anthropologists and archaeologists, sociologists, psychologists, they all seem to be moving from a quite cynical view of human nature, of who we are as a species, to a more hopeful view. And at one point, I was talking to a psychologist who is just been doing some brilliant research into how people behave in, you know, emergencies, and that they most of the time they actually help each other. And then I was telling her about, you know, new research from biology, and that biologists now believe that we have sort of evolved to be friendly. They literally talk about survival of the friendliest. And then she said to me, oh my God, so it's happening there as well. And that's when I realized, maybe this is a book.
And as you mentioned there, it looks at several different disciplines, right? Like when you look at the stories and the research that you draw on, it comes from several different points of view. There's philosophy, yes. There's biology, there's psychology. Was it important to you that ultimately what you reflect in the book shows all these examples and thoughts from different disciplines?
Yes, I think so. The book is really an argument against a very old theory that has been really influential, I think especially so in Western culture. And that's the idea of veneer theory, which says that supposedly our civilization is only a very thin veneer, only a very thin layer. And that when something happens, when there's a crisis, for example, like a pandemic or a natural disaster or you name it, that people become savages and that we revert to our dark selves and that we're all very selfish. Now, this idea has been really, really influential in Western history. You find it with the ancient Greeks, with Orthodox Christianity, with the Enlightenment philosophers. I think it's even embedded at the heart of our current capitalist system, right? The idea that people are just selfish and we have to deal with it. And it really started with me looking at a lot of sociological research. Because if you look, for example, at the behavior of people after natural disasters, it's pretty much the opposite. What you get every single time, and we have now more than 700 case studies, what you get is an explosion of altruism and cooperation. You know, people from the left to the right, rich, poor, young, old, working together. And that seemed to me an important story to tell, especially right now.
So this core concept that you illustrate for us in this book, this idea that, well, I mean, the title says it all, the idea that humans are essentially kind and that we're driven by the desire to be good to each other. Now, that actually takes on and sort of debunks works by some pretty established names, you know, from Jared Diamond, yeah, to Malcolm Gladwell, Dawkins, Yuval Noah Harari. Was there at all some trepidation that you were taking on these big names?
A little bit. And I mean, they're in a way, they're my heroes, right? And I read all their books. I used to have a more cynical view of human nature. You know, in earlier books, I had written about, you know, the Easter Island and the dark story of how this civilization supposedly destroyed itself. I had written about, for example, the Stanford Prison Experiment that listeners may have heard of. You know, this very famous experiment in psychology by Philip Zimbardo, who had 24 students, divided them into guards and prisoners, and sort of showed that if you put people in a uniform, they very quickly sort of develop this sadistic behavior if you give them the freedom to do whatever they want. So I used to believe all of that. It was only while writing this book that I discovered that, you know, I had to update my worldview and that many of these stories and experiments were in fact incorrect.
And in line with that, what are the challenges of trying to dismantle these sort of sensationalist stories that have become somewhat rooted in history and also pop culture parlance? Because you mentioned there the Stanford Prison Experiment, which, like you rightly said, I think a lot of people just casually bring up when they're saying, yeah, you see, people are terrible. I'm also thinking here of Kitty Genovese, because, you know, that murder has ended up becoming almost synonymous with the bystander effect. When I read about it, it gave me chills. And so reading your chapter on Kitty Genovese really, really challenged me. But at the same time, I also wonder, you know, whether or not it's enough to do away with everyone else just sort of casually using it the way we always have.
Yeah, well, these stories have become very, very established. You know, they're so popular and they're still in the psychology textbooks of millions of students around the globe. But in the case of the Stanford Prison Experiment, we now know that Philip Zimbardo, the researcher, you know, specifically instructed the students to be as sadistic as possible. And many of them said, I don't want to do it. You know, that's not who I am. And then he said, look, come on, you got to do it because I need these results so that we can go to the press and say, oh, these prisons are horrible environments. But somehow sort of the cynical stories that tell something nasty about who we are, they tend to spread like a virus, right? We can't get rid of them. While I think the more realistic stories about human cooperation and human friendliness, we tend to forget those.
And you indict the media in this, don't you? You sort of point out that the media plays a huge part in the stories they choose to perpetuate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think it's important, though, to make a distinction between the news and journalism. So I'm a big believer in good journalism, right? Everyone should subscribe to, I don't know, a good newspaper or a magazine, because investigative journalism, independent journalism is so important to uncover the structural forces that govern our lives and to hold those in power accountable, et cetera, et cetera. It's very important. But the news, sort of the sensational reporting on incidents that happen, you know, today instead of stuff that happens every day, I don't know. The news is not good for you. There's so much evidence now from psychology that it's like it's really not good for your mental health. There's even a term for this now, which is mean Walt syndrome. People who follow too much of the news, who've been consuming this drug too much, they become more cynical, they become more anxious, they become more depressed. And cynical people don't change the world.
I think a lot of journalists and news people would probably identify with a lot of what you just said anyway. We also talked, I think, earlier about these individual stories, but you extend the central idea of your book to some pretty difficult points in history. And they're also ones that often get brought up as an example of, man at their base, fundamentally evil. And I'm thinking here particularly of the Holocaust. Were you concerned about these being, I guess, in some senses, sacred cows, things that people just could not move on?
Yes, of course. And I mean, it's the big question that hovers over my book. On the one hand, I'm arguing that people have evolved to be friendly. As I said, it's survival of the friendliest, which means that for millennia, it's actually the friendliest among us who had the most kids and so had the biggest chance of passing on their genes to the next generation. But then on the other hand, you have to answer the question, then how can we also be the cruelest species in the animal kingdom? Right? We do things that other animals would never imagine doing, like locking up groups of people, killing them, exterminating them, ethnic cleansing, genocide, et cetera, et cetera. The list is very long. So this is, I think, the irony of this book, is that if you write a book about human kindness, is that you have to go on for hundreds of pages about all the dark chapters in our history, because the mystery only becomes bigger. Now, to say just one thing about it, I think there's a connection between our capacity for friendliness and our tribal behavior and our groupish behavior. What you see as a historian is that so many of the atrocities we've committed, is we often do these in the name of loyalty and in the name of friendship and in the name of, you know, cooperation and working together. So sometimes this friendliness is exactly the problem.
On the line with us today, we have Rutger Bregman, who is a Dutch popular historian as well as author of a new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. And that is what we're talking about today. If you have any thoughts on the book, or really in some ways on the central premise of it all, let us know. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. We are going to be right back. You are listening to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. On the line with us today, we have Rutger Bregman, who has written a new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History. And that is the book that we're discussing today. So we've established that it puts forth, in the simplest of terms, the notion that as humans, we are fundamentally decent and that in some ways it's the systems that we enter that change that. So Rutger, we talked earlier about how the book draws on lots of different disciplines, lots of different mm-hmm. stories. And I guess I wanted to know, what are the benefits of reading a book like this, where you see a lot of research being synthesized as opposed to mm-hmm. maybe diving into the research itself?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the problems with the modern university these days is that you've got all these really brilliant people doing such brilliant but very specialized research, is that they often don't know what's going on in the field next to theirs. So I guess I've just been lucky that I work at a journalism platform called The Correspondent that's a little bit in between the news and academia. So I get the freedom to then study sociology for a couple of months and then psychology for a couple of months and then anthropology for a couple of months. So you have the ability to zoom out and then you start seeing things that otherwise I think you wouldn't see. And that's really what I'm trying to do in this book, is to connect the dots, to show that something bigger is going on. On the one hand, in science, so you've got all these scientists from different disciplines moving to a more hopeful view of human nature, but also in society. So you've got so many people now trying to build new schools, new organizations, new workplaces, experiments with different kinds of democracies, you name it, who are all trying to implement this more hopeful view of human nature. And this is really a bigger movement, although these people often don't realize that they're actually part of this bigger movement.
So I don't know whether you've come across this this particular attitude that I'm about to explain to you, but certainly here in Malaysia, many people tend to take this perspective that when we talk about successes from other places, you know, news of good things happening somewhere else, sometimes the reaction tends to be, oh, well, they can do it there, but not here. You know, they're a richer country mm-hmm. or they're smaller or it's part of their culture. How would you respond to this point of view?
Well, I think it's a very good point. You also have to look at the local circumstances and the local culture and what works there may not work here, et cetera, et cetera. But I've tried to give a lot of examples from around the globe in this book. So one of my favorite examples, for example, is all these experiments with participatory democracy in Latin America specifically. So what would a democracy look like if you actually assume that people can be creative citizens, you know, not just people who sit on the couch all day and just want to watch Netflix and then maybe vote every 3 or 4 years? But what if we assume that they actually want to participate and engage? Well, what you can then do is to bring them around a table, whether they're left wing or right wing, rich, poor, young, old, and to let them have constructive discussions on really complex and difficult, controversial subjects. And turns out that when you do this, it actually works. You know, people have very sensible discussions and they come up with reasonable compromises. Now, we've now had experiments with this in 1,500 cities from around the globe. So I think that we can say that this is something that can be scaled up around the globe. But it started, interestingly, in Latin America, where social trust is relatively low. So you wouldn't have expected it to start there, but it did.
And I suppose on a related note, are there gaps, you think, in your book when it comes to a non-European or Western perspective? Because I think, like you rightly point out, you look at different stories from around the globe. And yet, of course, I think most of us are going to be limited by where we are and our own personal weight and perspective in terms of, you know, where we come from, what we studied.
Yes, it's absolutely true. And that's why I'm very curious how, you know, people in other cultures will read the book. As I said, the book is, in principle, an argument against the very Western idea. You know, I think it's this Western idea that people are fundamentally selfish that has also become the basis of a very individualistic culture. That's what I'm arguing against. We do know, obviously, that the idea had global, you know, repercussions, if only because of colonialism. I think that veneer theory, that, you know, the idea that civilization is only a thin veneer, has often been used as a legitimization of power differences and oppression and hierarchies. Because, you know, if we can't trust each other, if people cannot govern themselves on their own, well, then they need the generals and the kings and the monarchs and the queens. right? But if we can actually trust each other, then we can maybe move to a much more egalitarian, genuinely democratic society. So I'm very curious to hear how readers in other places will read the book.
Well, you did mention, though, that you ran the premises and stories of the book by some of your friends and your peers. What were their reactions like? And, you know, did some of these reactions change or adapt your initial idea?
Well, when you write a book like this about how most people are pretty decent, so the reaction you get all the time is, yeah, but what about this? Yeah, but what about that? So I knew that it had to become, you know, a quite long book. And in a way, I was writing it against myself as well. For example, I've got one story in the book about what happens when kids shipwreck on an island, sort of the real Lord of the Flies story. Now, in the fictional Lord of the Flies, the famous novel by William Golding, these kids become savages, right? Even though they come from very nice British boarding schools, they quickly turn into monsters when they get the freedom to just do whatever they want on this uninhabited island. And then for this book, I started to look whether it ever actually really happened. And I did find one example in 1965, where six Tongan kids, Tonga, the island group in the Pacific Ocean, were also at a boarding school, didn't like their school, so they were bored, and they stole a boat, went to sail, but ended up in a storm, drifted for 8 days, shipwrecked on a small island, and survived there for 50 months. And how did they survive? Well, because they stayed friends all this time. They worked together really well. And actually, they're friends up until this day. I managed to track down two of them, interviewed them. And yeah, they're still really good friends. And now Hollywood is going to make a movie about this whole story. So, but if it would be a fictional story, then people would say, oh, that is so unrealistic. That is so sentimental. That would never happen. But here we are. It's the real Lord of the Flies.
And that leads us pretty neatly to our next question, really, which is that, and this is something that comes up throughout the book, this idea that a lot of us are contending with cynics, both external and internal, right? This idea that sometimes within ourselves also we think, ah, you know, you can't trust that person, it's just not right. In line with that, I think reading these arguments, like you said, when it's presented as a real story, you're like, that can't be true. How do you contend with that, I suppose, as you were writing the book?
I think the main objective of the book is that I want to redefine what it means to be a realist. So often when we say, oh, come on, you got to be a bit more realistic. We say, oh, you got to be more pessimistic, a bit more cynical. And I think that's wrong. It's actually the cynics who are really naive. And if you have a more hopeful view of who we are as a species, I think you're much more realistic. I'm not saying we're angels. Clearly we're not, right? We're capable of very nasty things, of jealousy, of aggression, of violence. But I think the reason why we conquered the globe, right? Why we built pyramids and spaceships and you name it. Why we're still here and the Neanderthals are gone. The reason for that is that we have this true superpower, which is the superpower to cooperate on a skill that other species just can't. And I think we need to reconnect with that superpower.
I do like that you redefine what being a realist means. Mm. That's something that I really did take away from the book. However, the thing that I wanted to ask you was that you do talk about systemic change. And in huge systems and institutions, you know, things like democracy and education, justice systems, do you really think the kind of changes that you're talking about are possible to be implemented on a large global scale?
I think so, yeah. It just takes a lot of small steps, you know. If you want to travel, make a very long journey, you have to take thousands or hundreds of thousands of small steps. That's how it works. I've got one example in my book about how they radically reformed the prison system in Norway. Now, in the 1970s, Norwegian prisons were very strict, you know, sort of the traditional prisons with a very high recidivism rate, so a very high chance that someone will commit another crime once he or she gets out of prison. Now, in the decades that followed, they totally reformed the thing. Now in Norway, they have a system where people come in as criminals, but they come out as citizens. They have the lowest recidivism rate in the world, the lowest chance that someone will commit another crime. How do they do this? Well, they built a system that it doesn't really look like prisons anymore, to be honest. So the inmates get the freedom to socialize with the guards, to go to the cinema, to go to the library, to work on themselves, to, you know, work on their education, to make music. They've got their own music studio. They've got their own music label, which is called Criminal Records, right? So it looks very crazy on the one hand. But then on the other hand, if you look at the statistics, if you look at the science behind it, these are the most effective prisons in the world. The chance that someone will find a job after he or she gets out of a Norwegian prison, you know, is like 40% higher. So this is an investment that pays for itself in the long run. That took a long time, right? It was a long journey for Norway, but now they're, I think, a beacon for the world. And I think we should, follow their lead.
Your book has really come out at a perfect time. And reading it, honestly, over the last week or so, against the backdrop of everything that's going on, was an incredibly interesting and also very enriching experience, because we're in the midst of a global pandemic. We're also seeing revolutions. We're seeing a lot of anger around the world. And there's, I think, a lot of talk at the moment about rethinking, reinventing how we've been doing things thus far. There's this real desire for positivity. How do you see the concepts in your book being played out in this current phase of human history, knowing everything that's going on?
Well, we're coming out of an era in our history of about 40 years that I think was sort of based around the values of selfishness and competition, right? Started in the 70s, but especially in the 80s with the rise of Ronald Reagan in the US and Thatcher in the UK. The greed is good mantra, right? And we've seen the results. An epidemic of loneliness and anxiety, inequality increasing around the globe. And now we've got so many people at the top who are quite corrupted by power. I mean, this is another important mechanism in the book that I talk about. Most people are pretty decent, but power corrupts. And now we're in this pandemic, and suddenly things are changing so quickly. What my hope is, not my prediction, but what I hope, and this is a scenario, it's a possibility, is that we can leave the era of selfishness and competition behind us, and we can move in a new era that is defined around the different values, the values of cooperation and solidarity.
So what is the one message that you'd like readers to take away from reading Humankind?
Don't be ashamed to sort of be kind. And, you know, often there's this, people feel a bit ashamed, you know, they don't want to be naive. They don't want to come across as sentimental. I'm just trying to say to them, you know what, you're the real realist here. You've got science behind you. And maybe most importantly, your behavior is contagious. And this is exactly what makes us so special as a species, right? If you do kind to someone else, then you can inspire this or that person. It's just like with viruses. Our behavior is also contagious. And I think that's maybe especially important to remember right now when we really need to cooperate.
Rutger, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Rutger Bregman, who is a Dutch popular historian, also an author currently of a new book, Humankind, A Hopeful History, which is what we've been discussing today. If you have any thoughts that you'd like to share, again, you can, of course, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
The Flies by William Golding, read by Martin Jarvis. Chapter 1. The Sound of the Shell. The boy with fair hair lowered himself down the last few feet of rock and began to pick his way towards the lagoon. Though he had taken off his school sweater and trailed it now from one hand, his grey shirt stuck to him, and his hair was plastered to his forehead. All round him, the long scar smashed into the jungle was a bath of heat. He was clambering heavily among the creepers and broken trunks when a bird, a vision of red and yellow, flashed upwards with a witch-like cry. And this cry was echoed by another. "Hi!" it said. "Wait a minute!" The undergrowth at the side of the scar was shaken, and a multitude of raindrops fell, pattering. "Wait a minute!" the voice said. "I got caught up!" The fair boy stopped and jerked his...
And that brings us to footnotes, where after our conversation with Rutger, we thought that it would be an opportune time to dive into William Golding's Lord of the Flies. It is actually one of the central chapters in the book where he goes out and tries to identify whether Lord of the Flies would have happened in real life.
Yes, and for many people, I think it was also because the excerpt of that chapter was published in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, and that got a lot of people talking, because essentially The Lord of the Flies is a story of what happens when a group of British schoolboys, boarding schoolboys, end up shipwrecked on an island. And
the answer is nothing good, friends.
No, it is. It is. I'm still traumatized by much of the book. But basically, you know, they devolve into savagery. And the basic premise of that book is that at the heart of every civilized human being, there is a savage. And you just need to remove... And Rutger Bregman talks about in this book that the idea that it's just a veneer of civilization that covers it. Yes, I think both Lynn and I have a lot of very deep push-down emotions about this book.
And it's an interesting one, because Lord of the Flies is often regarded as one of the masterpieces of English literature. It is taught in schools. Mm-hmm. It is something that makes reading lists for adults and young adults alike.
It was the basis for Survivor and a whole bunch of other reality TV shows.
Sure. So because of that, I think Lord of the Flies is something like To Kill a Mockingbird. It's just one of those books where they tell you, you have to read this. And so when I read it, I was the same. We were just talking about this. I was the same age actually as the boys in question. So Ralph, Jack, Piggy, who kind of form the central crux, I suppose, of the Lord of the Flies stories, because Ralph is the at first unwilling leader who then is put in a position of trying to defend his position. You have Jack, who is an unhinged hunter type who starts off
as a choir boy.
Correct. Yeah. Who's also seeking power. And then you have Piggy, who is nicknamed as such because he's overweight, he wears spectacles, he is boring. He's the one who's like, guys, we need to organize, we need to get things straight, we need to do things right. And things just kind of go from there. And when I read the book, I remember thinking that it was a very convincing book, because it lays on this argument that we all, and that our parents tell us, don't trust strangers. You know, people are not that good. You really have to mind yourself. And so I think it leans into that, and then you go with it. But I also remember looking around at my classmates and thinking, I don't see us in this. I don't see that this would happen to us if we were the people on the plane.
So I read this book when I was... I think older than you were. So I was already a teenager, and I believe my late teens. And it was also the same time that I was hearing about things like ragging in colleges and my male friends being, you know, going for their scout outings, and how the older boys would really, it sounded to me like torture the younger boys. And so also being that age where you're kind of on that crux of, oh, I want to be cynical about the world and, you know, gaze at the darkness of the human
heart. Wear eyeliner.
Right. And yes, absolutely. I think I was very much on board with the concept at the heart of this book, that essentially most people aren't very good. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. And, you know, Golding is a great writer. He won the Nobel Prize. Highly recommend it as something to read. But the reason I sound so uncertain about it is that, you know, after reading Rutger Bregman's book, a lot of what I used to think about Lord of the Flies has changed. And I think in some ways, I feel like it's a good idea to read the book, but also to think about, is this a cautionary tale? Or is this, you know, how do you want to approach the story?
Right. And I think it's best approached as a parable in that sense, but also not to then extend it backwards and say, ergo, all humans are like this, which is what the book in some way wants you to do, right? It was written with a very specific purpose. It was born from a very specific premise, which was to say that no matter how polite a British schoolboy looks, strip that all away, put him on an island, and before you know it, savagery. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I agree with you, it's very... It's a great book in the sense that it's so well written. It's really well constructed. I read it in you know, I just kind of read it very, very quickly, because it's written in a way that draws you further and further into the drama of these boys. But I'm so relieved also as an adult to have some distance from the book, and also now to have research that supports the idea that this is not necessarily what would happen. Because when Rutger Bregman writes about the real Lord of the Flies, it is a very, very different story.
When Manu Tutau was just 16, he had an experience that changed his life forever.
Sometimes I sit down and I think about the island. In the 2 years that I was there, I could not stop crying.
In 1965, he was one of six teenagers from Tonga who borrowed a boat and attempted to sail to Fiji, only to spend 8 days lost at sea before their boat was wrecked on the coast of a lonely island called Uta. They made a garden, a badminton court, even a guitar from coconuts and driftwood.
Next, they made a house.
Eventually, they built a thatched dwelling and ways to capture fresh water.
It was beginning to seem...
No, and it's a story that made me so happy to read. It made me feel so much hope for humankind, because the story that he tells of a group of Tongan schoolboys who do end up shipwrecked for, I think, 15 months on an island, they had rules like, we won't quarrel. Mm. They would sit apart until they got over their anger and then come back together and resolve their issues.
They did keep a fire going.
They kept a fire going. One of them fell and broke his leg and the others nursed him back to health. I mean, it might sound cheesy and I don't know. You know what? After reading Bregman, I'm no longer ashamed to say it's fine to want to think the best of people. And this is one of those stories that really does make you feel that way.
Guys, they built a badminton court on that island. No, I mean, I think that's something. Yeah. I think that really tells you something about the level of organization and togetherness that people can have. It doesn't all have to go straight to the beast and all the rest of it, which, yeah, read Lord of the Flies like a horror story. I think maybe that's the best way to go about it. It's a wonder... It's a great book. I was going to say wonderful and then I stopped. It's a
yeah, no, wonderful would not be the word, I think.
It's a great book. It's a classic for a reason. And it is a horror story. I think it also falls neatly into a specific genre, which is that of the British boarding school drama, because yeah, that is its own thing. Not everything is Mallory Towers. Whenever you read stories from... There's a fair amount of books and stories written by British authors who have gone through British prep.
Boy by Roald Dahl is amazing.
Exactly. Who have gone through British prep and boarding schools, which tell a variety of stories. But there's also a fair amount of trauma that comes out of those books. So I think maybe fitting Lord of the Flies into that, as opposed to thinking of it as a human nature story, might be easier.
And also perhaps, as Bregman points out, to think of Golding himself as someone who dealt with a lot of issues of his own and struggles, and that this is very much his worldview of what people would be like.
So yes, let us know. Have you read Lord of the Flies? And, you know, the thing that keeps coming to mind is, if you guys have seen Community, there is a debate that happens in one of the early episodes, which is man is good versus man is evil. And I guess that's the question I'm putting out to you. What is your fundamental worldview? You know, where are you coming at it from? And do you plan to read Humankind? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. And if you have longer thoughts, you can, of course, write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. You've been listening to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.